My name is Scott McKnight, and I'm a professor of New Testament at Northern Seminary in Lisle, Illinois, just in the western suburbs of Chicago.
And my name is Cody Matchett. I am a PhD student in New Testament and a pastor from Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Dr. Scott McKnight, Cody as well, good to see you both today.
Good to see you.
Thanks for being a part of our conversation. We're going to be talking about a book that you guys have done together, and I'm always fascinated by that because I've done some books with other people, how the process worked. But it's entitled Revelation for the Rest of Us, A Prophetic Call to Follow Jesus as a Dissident Disciple. Interesting words there, published by Zondervan Press, and it's fairly recent in publication. First of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, David.
Let's talk a little bit about your collaboration. How did you guys come to collaborate on this book? Cody, let's start with you.
Yeah, I, like many other students, came to Northern Seminary to work with Dr. McKnight. And upon my arrival, I had taken a few classes, and then Scott invited me to be a part of this project with him. It was in the early stages at that time. And so he invited me to be a part of it. And I, of course, said yes without knowing anything else about what the project would entail.
You had read the book of Revelation, though, right?
I have. Yes,
okay, good,
I had.
Good. Okay. You had read it. Scott, tell me a little bit about your invitation.
Cody was my graduate assistant, actually. He was working with me, and I think he was working with Nijay or about the same time, or then started working with Nijay too, because he was an outstanding student that we had, and he could do Greek and Hebrew very well and loved studying the Bible. As a TA, I was writing lectures for a class based on years of wanting to say something about the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. And then I would pass stuff on to him, and then I taught the course. Cody taught some of it, but I sent the notes to him all the time. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, I think we've got a book here. So I said, as soon as the class is over, I'm going to start writing, or as soon as my lectures were done prepared. Mm-hmm. I think by December 1st, I was already writing, and I would pass stuff to Cody. And then after a while, I'm not sure that we sent a proposal to Zondervan apart from the whole manuscript, but I think maybe we did. They gave us a contract, and then we started writing and went back and forth the way co-authors do, and Cody added this, and then I would add this, and he wrote some of the sidebars. And that way I can always say, if someone disagrees, I can always say, Cody wrote that. I don't know what he said.
I disavow any knowledge of that, right? I don't know how that ended up in the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great book. Let me just say this. And, you know, Beth Allison Barr said at the very top, it's promotion, this is the most powerful interpretation of Revelation I have read. That is high praise. High praise indeed. Yeah. So let me ask this. Scott, from reading it, sounds like you and I heard some of the same sermons and saw some of the same movies, A Thief in the Night, and were scared to death and read some of the same books at the time. But that was a very, and what you guys call a speculative view of Revelation. Unpack that a little bit for us.
Well, David, I don't know if you had the experience I had. I remember as about a 10 or 11-year-old, I was in my driveway running hurdles. My dad was a track coach, so I was always doing stuff with the hurdles. And it was getting darker and darker. And my parents weren't home, and my sisters weren't home, and I thought the rapture had occurred. I thought I was left behind way before Tim LaHaven used that expression. So I grew up in that. But the question whether we agree, whether we had the same experience, is did you read Salem Kurban's Guide to Survival?
I didn't read that one, no.
He was Hal Lindsey before Hal Lindsey became Hal Lindsey.
Okay. All right.
And
so
he wrote
going
this
back.
Book on, it's a guide to survive the tribulation if you didn't get raptured. And it was just sort of a graphic discussion of the whole book of Revelation. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker. My parents thought it was good. My youth pastor thought it was the best thing going. And then I had a kind of an awakening, illuminating experience, enlightenment in college when I first encountered other interpretations of the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think by the time I got to seminary, I was no longer interested in the rapture and the book of Revelation questioned like that. And it was my PhD work of reading through all the Jewish apocalypses that convinced me that that sort of reading of Revelation, which is so literal, ultimately fails miserably in the book of Revelation.
Well, Cody, your experience, tell me a little bit about that starting off. And I don't know if this is true, just an observation, is that when we're younger, we seem to sort of get caught up into the eschatological stuff more. And then as we get older, we sort of move away from that. It's still important, but it's not as important as it used to be. Cody, what about your experience?
Yeah, I've noticed a bit of a generational divide and gap on this question. And Scott and I actually chatted about this quite frequently. When I didn't grow up in the church. And so when I first, it's interesting you asked me if I had read the book of Revelation, because when I first came to church, I was like, I don't know what that book's about, but the way people talk about it can't be right. I mean, I was able to recognize that pretty early on. And so I had the experience that what I've noticed with a lot of my younger students now that they have, which is my students just don't want to read it at all. They have no interest in eschatology because they know that the people who are speculating about this plague is COVID-19 and this is a B-52 bomber, which are ancient history now. And that sort of approach, they could recognize that speculation approach, speculating about the signs of the times, is not the right way to read it. Mm. And so for them, they would rather have a form of silence at this point. I don't know what that book's about, but I don't really want to talk about it. And that was probably my experience for quite a while. I know that something's wrong, but I don't know the right way to read it. And so then I sort of throw my hands in the air and say, anything after those speeches to the churches from Jesus, I don't know about that stuff. That would have been my former approach. And I see that a lot in young students.
And so after chapter 3, there's not really much to say at that point. You guys describe four different kind of perspectives. One is the preterist view, which says basically everything was written for and about the first century. And maybe we can read it with profit, but it's really about the first century. And then there's a historic view, which views Revelation coming forth in the ages of the church or the period of the church. And then there's the idealist view. Where do you guys fall on that? There's other views as well, but where do you guys fall on that, Scott?
Well, the way I like to talk about those four views is they're framed by time of when this stuff is happening. Did it happen in the first century? Is it going to be futurist and happen in the future? Is it all the time? I think confuses the book as an apocalypse. I don't think it's that predictive the way people talk about it. So I call the view that we've articulated a theopolitical hermeneutic, that it teaches us how to think about the politics of our world in the categories of how God sees it. But I like to think that I'm a preterist who sees the text as having a timelessness about it, rather than an idealist, because I think it was definitely written to seven churches in Western Asia Minor in the first century, and that Babylon is Rome of the first century. So it's really anchored in that time, but it has this sort of cosmic vision that transcends time as well. So I'll say it as a timeliness that becomes a timelessness.
That's a good way of saying it. If you read it as a speculative thing, futurist only, then the people who first received it are left scratching their heads. This means nothing to me, right? I have no clue what any of this means. But if you're able to see it as ciphers of what's happening in the theopolitical realms, or in the political realms at least, and there's kind of a call then for that. So to read it well, you say you've got to read it theopolitically, and you've got to see God in part of that politics. I heard one time that politics participates in the modest dignity of the penultimate, which is a really interesting way of thinking about politics. I think I read it in First Things. But it's talking about the importance of politics, but it's always penultimate to the ultimate. And it can only impart to us a kind of modest dignity. It can't impart to us any kind of long-term dignity. It's a beautiful statement. But as you think about the book of Revelation, does that ring true for you guys? Some statement like that, that politics participates in the modest dignity of the penultimate.
I think that's what Revelation is actually doing, is it's describing Rome as Babylon, as a corruption, giving a divine perspective on Rome in order to understand that that sort of government has to go down before justice can come. And then you will find a new Jerusalem, which sort of forms a utopia. It's not long enough to give us much vision of the utopia, or the passages aren't, but it sketches the erasure of injustices in Babylon in order to give the vision of New Jerusalem. So it sounds like First Things, and it sounds like a justification for participating in politics more than I would do.
Yeah.
But it is, there is something really helpful about that statement.
One of the things you talk about, how necessary government is. I mean, no matter what the government is that we have, government seems certainly necessary to the human society. And yet governments are almost always prone to some kind of corruption that is deep and wide as well. But what I hear you saying is that we ought to look beyond that, and we ought not, as Americans particularly, or Westerners in general, to put too much credit onto those who are our politicians. They can only do so much, and very often what they do is the wrong thing, or a selfish thing, or a corrupt thing, because as soon as they do something good, they turn around and do something that's not so good. Cody, does that ring true for you?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's really easy for our eschatological hope, the hope of the New Jerusalem, the erasure of evil, these things that Scott mentioned. I think that for a lot of younger Christians, at least in my country, in my context, there is not only an abandonment of eschatology, but actually an abandonment of the church in this belief that politics will save, that actually this kind of social amelioration project will bring about the New Jerusalem. And the sad irony at times is that sometimes what we're doing is we're deeply believing that we're building the New Jerusalem, but we're actually building the new iteration of Babylon while we are celebrating the fall of a former iteration of Babylon. Mm-hmm. And we don't have the apocalyptic vision to see it for what it really is, I think.
That's a good point.
We should have written that in a paragraph in the book. That's very
I started
good.
To say that needs to be written
like
up.
That.
What we've seen, it seems like, in the West is this, and we have sayings like this, you have to fight fire with fire, right? Mm-hmm. The political drama that's out there, we have to fight that with other kind of political drama. And if you can't beat them, join them kind of thing. We're sort of always being enjoined to participate in Babylon, in a sense, mm-hmm. and do it the Babylonian way. But that seems to be the opposite of the vision, Scott, that I hear you guys portraying with Revelation, that in fact Babylon has got to be completely and totally dismantled.
Well, okay, the second half of the first century was the church's opportunity to explore how the church was going to relate to the powers of this age.
Yeah.
So let's just say from late 30s on, Paul begins to get into this situation in the diaspora. And at first, you know, they could just kind of meld into the local synagogue and just kind of carry on the synagogue's relationship. But in the pages of the New Testament, I think we see four different visions of how to relate to the state. So Jesus has a riddle: give to Caesar what's Caesar and to God's what's God's. And some days I think I know what that means, and other days I don't. But Paul has a Romans 13 that I think is accommodationist for a missional purpose, and probably, a critique of zealots. But nonetheless, it's a sort of just stay out of trouble so that we can do what we're called to do.
Mm-hmm.
The pastorals are, let's go to 1 Peter. Peter says we need to become more activist in 1 Peter chapter 2, 11 through today, 17. We need to be more activist in doing good in the public sector. I mean, he uses this Greek verb, agathopoeo, quite often, and it's noun form. And
to
that's
do good.
Public benevolence.
Practice the good. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's public benevolence in Bruce Winter's really excellent book gets into this. But then the pastorals use the Greek word eusebia, which is often translated godliness. But Chris Hakletubby has made a really good case that this word means civilized piety or a socially respectable religious practice. And so here in the pastorals, we've got Paul, you know, probably still saying now we're, it's a little bit, I'm a little bit more advanced than Romans 13 now. We're learning in the Western Asia Minor that we got to act like this. We got to conduct ourselves in ways that are acceptable and respectable. And then Revelation says, I've had it. Got to burn the place down. So it is.
So Revelation, which came first? Which came first, right?
Yeah, I think Revelation's later than anything else in the New Testament. But I do think that John has realized that Babylon creep is going on in the church, and we got to sit hard on this. And when John chose to write an apocalypse, he chose, in a sense, to get himself in trouble with postmoderns today, because it's so either or, it's so black and white, it's so you're in and you're out, it's so much judgment of God. But, you know, you can't really blame John for doing what apocalypses do when he chose to write an apocalypse.
That's right. So that was the genre that he chose, right?
Yeah,
and you've read enough to know exactly how those kind of symbols work within the world of the apocalypse. If there's any particular takeaway from the book, what would you want it to be, Scott? We'll start with you and then Cody.
Okay.
So if people have read your book, what do they walk away thinking now, doing now, being now?
Yeah, I think it's very important, and I think we have quite a bit about this. It takes a while for us to want to get to where it is, because we want to lay the groundwork for understanding how to read Revelation. But to me, John is in a situation where they're powerless, and the powers are beginning to make their presence felt in the church. And John has sort of three strategies: discern Babylon and Babylon creep in the church. The second thing is he calls them to be faithful, allegiant witnesses to Jesus, which means speaking up and speaking out, confessing your faith, and it means putting your body on the line. It's an embodied witness. And the third thing, which I think is the most revolutionary dimension, is he teaches them to worship the Lamb. And any act of worshiping the Lamb as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, which is not from Handel, that's actually from the Bible. Any worship of Jesus, the Lamb, as the Lord and King of Kings is subversive. So they learn to be dissidents when they worship the Lamb. And here's what I would say. This is not so true of Canada, because it's a perfect country for Cody.
Kinder but and gentler. Yeah.
The more we worship the Lamb, the more perceptive we will be of the presence of Babylon. And I believe the chaos in American churches today is a direct result of its failure to worship the Lamb.
But we're going to worship, right? I mean, we're going to services.
With an American flag behind the pulpit.
We're going through the motions, but the question is, are we truly worshiping when we get there? Is it not a show? Is it not a performance? Is it not one of these other things? Finally, I have to ask you about the Barman Declaration. I mean, that is really such a powerful part of your book. Cody, was that your idea? Or Scott, was that your idea? Cody, what do you think about that?
It was Scott's idea first.
Okay.
Scott sent me an email one day and said, what do you think of the Barman Declaration? I think it might be a good place for us to land this. And I said, I'll read it.
Been a while since you had read that, probably, right?
Yeah, I was not quite as familiar with the Barman Declaration at that moment in time. So I read it. In fact, this last time I read through, I just taught a class on Revelation this last winter with 30 students, and this was for our last class. I had them read the Barman Declaration, I did, and they really actually appreciated it. But I'll let Scott take away on the Barman Declaration.
So Scott, for those who don't know, can't remember, or you know, are younger and don't know the Barman Declaration, what was that exactly?
This is about Hitler's Germany and the rise of the German church, Die Deutsche Christen, which was a total conflation, mixture of the church with the state, so much so that the state was beginning to overcome the church. And there's a lot of things to say about this. Karl Barth was the leading voice in the Barman Declaration, where some German pastors met together. And, you know, it all has to be tied eventually to the Confessing Church, the Bekennende Kirche in Germany. And Bonhoeffer, you know, was significant in that, especially for Americans who don't know that much about what happened. But they came together and basically decided that they were going to announce that Jesus was Lord and that Hitler was not, without getting themselves killed. You know, Bart was put on trial in Germany for his lack of commitment to Hitler, and because he didn't want to say Heil Hitler at the beginning of his class. And he gets before the judge and he expounds the first two commandments.
Wow.
And I thought, I feel like we're in this state in the United States, with some people, with Christian nationalism, with the partisanship of American Christians. They're either so Democrat that the Republicans are demons, or they're so Republican that the Democrats are demons, that we have sold out to the political process. And I thought the Barman Declaration could provide an outline of the sorts of things we could talk about. And Cody helped with this. You know, this wasn't just my text with Cody adding some footnotes. So he made contributions everywhere. And
of course,
and one of his advantages, he helped clarify prose at times where I made assumptions that Cody has thought nobody that I teach would have any idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I think the Barman Declaration, I mean, I make my joke to say Scott had sent me the email, and then it became this wonderful world within which we could write a chapter. But I think it does become, it sounds maybe negative in some ways, but as Scott is articulating, kind of a society of people who are saying, yeah, this is, yeah, there's partisanship, there's division, there's compromise.
There's
and
danger.
And we're coming around this.
Yeah, there's danger.
We're coming around this and we're signing it. And I think to come back to, you know, Scott made all these points about what do we want people to walk away with when they read our book and think about Revelation. And we start with imagination. And I think that where this goes wrong, and I have workshopped this with students and with people in my churches, I think it begins with a total co-opting of the imagination. And once your imagination has been assaulted, and now I'm working with Walter Brueggemann here in his book, The Prophetic Imagination, but once your ability to imagine has been so assaulted by the royal consciousness, as Brueggemann calls it, you can't conceptualize any other futures or any other ways of moving forward other than what that royal consciousness wants you to think. And I think that the Barman Declaration in and of itself invites us, yes, into these acts of prayer and worship and confession, to bring us back to, as Scott said, worshiping the Lamb so that we can discern the powers of Babylon in our day.
And that will certainly show the difference between those who are dissidents and disciples and those who have been co-opted by Babylon. Really enjoyed the book. For those who haven't seen it, the title of the book is called Revelation for the Rest of Us, A Prophetic Call to Follow Jesus as a Dissident Disciple, published by Zondervan. It's a great book. It's a book you got to sit with for a while, ponder it, but I think it really speaks to where we are right now in the West. So thank you guys for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David. We're honored to be with you.
One of the things I love about doing these podcasts is that inevitably I learned something, whether I wanted to or not. And today I did, and I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. For more info about our guest, check out our show notes. They're there for you. Subscribe to the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a comment. Rate us. You know the drill. We're on Apple and Google and Spotify and iHeartRadio and Stitcher and other places. I want to say thanks to those that make this podcast possible, for Kathy Capes, Jocelyn Solis, Phil Kagi, and the Lanier Foundation. Let's give it up for them. Cue the applause track. Thanks for listening.